From the Moan Broadcast Center at KPCC, this is The Frame. I'm John Horn. On today's show, Disney made a huge wager on Vice Media. It wishes it hadn't. Then when people passed on John Cameron Mitchell's idea for a musical about a cancer patient, he made it a podcast called Anthem.
I love marrying music to story. And we want Anthem to be a continuing series so that each season is a completely different musical written by different people. You know, Kendrick Lamar, we're available.
And Anita Sarkeesian was targeted by online haters for saying video games were sexist, but she's not backing down. All that coming up on The Frame. Welcome to The Frame. I'm John Horn. Thanks for joining us. Back in 2015, the family-friendly Walt Disney Company raised some eyebrows with a $400 million investment in Vice Media, a decidedly not safe for work, millennial-focused digital media company. Once a media darling valued at $5.7 billion, Vice has struggled in recent years, and now Disney says it's not expecting to get any return on its investment. Peter Kafka, the executive director at Recode, has been following the Disney-Vice downfall, and he explained what made the company so appealing to an investor like Disney.
Vice was a bunch of different things, but for a while it was going to solve all the problems that all the major TV media conglomerates had. It was going to find the elusive millennial, the elusive male millennial, and deliver video content and ideally advertising to them. And this was a pitch that seduced a lot of big media companies, including Fox, that's FOX, Time Warner, and most importantly, Disney.
And there was a point in time where they had a valuation that I suspect was just on paper of close to $6 billion. Where did that number come from, and why was that valuation so high?
Every year or so, Shane Smith, the impresario who ran Vice, would come out and announce that he had another record year selling advertising. His audience was growing and growing, and then he would raise more money at ever-increasing valuations. And he would float the idea that maybe he would take his company public, but everyone sort of assumed that the main idea was to eventually sell it to a Disney or a Fox or a Time Warner. And they got to $5.7 billion sort of at the crest when all these big digital media companies were raising tons of money.
So what was Disney's hope? What did they see in this company, and why was it for them, at least in theory, a good marriage between the two companies?
It's pretty puzzling even now, and people have been wondering about it for a long time, because Vice was in many ways the anti-Disney. It was deliberately edgy. It was deliberately not safe for work. That was supposed to be the appeal for these mythical, elusive male millennials as well. That's why they supposedly liked it. But the idea was this was going to help Disney find that next generation of consumers that maybe weren't watching ESPN or weren't watching Disney Channel, and Disney was unable to reach in other ways. It's also one of a series of digital bets that Disney has made that in retrospect haven't worked. It has not been very good at that. It's been very good at acquiring traditional assets. When it comes to spending money digitally, those deals have not generally worked.
So Vice's co-founder, Shane Smith, is no longer running Vice. There's a new woman, Nancy Dubeck, who came in from A&E Networks. Why did that happen, and what was her plan, or what are her plans with Vice going forward?
She'd been at A&E, and A&E had bet heavily on Vice as well. They had taken a low-rated channel called the H2 channel and turned it into something called Viceland. And the pitch there was that Vice's brand was so amazingly strong, again, with these elusive millennials, that it would get them to do something no one else could do, which was to pay for cable TV and watch cable TV. That hasn't proven out yet either. So in some ways, Nancy Dubeck has sort of, she broke it, she bought it, she's got to fix this mess. There's both the financial mess at Vice, they're missing their numbers, and there was obviously a big cultural issue at Vice. You know, for years, Vice had reveled in this idea that it was sort of transgressive and broke all kinds of rules, certainly treated people poorly, particularly women poorly. There was a much-discussed New York Times expose that came out in sort of the initial rush of Me Too stories. Vice had to apologize for that, and it became pretty clear that even though Shane Smith was in many ways Vice's primary asset, he's a primary salesperson, he's the brand, he couldn't be running the company.
The headline on your story is Disney put more than $400 million into Vice Media. Now it says that investment is worthless. Disney didn't exactly put out a press release saying that, but it is buried in a financial disclosure. What do the financial disclosures say, and how do they get to that zero valuation?
So Disney won't come out and say we value it at zero, and they don't technically value it at zero. They're just saying what they did is they wrote off their investment. So the number in yesterday's filing was, I believe, $353 million, and they used the term write-off, which means there's no more to write off. This is it. They'd previously written off $157 million in the fall. If you add that up, it gets above $400. But Disney is saying, we don't think we're ever going to get our money back, and so we're not going to tell investors that we have any value associated with our investment in Vice. This is an important nuance, but it doesn't mean that other people don't think there's value in Vice. There are other people who have put money in there, and for various financial reasons, there's still a possibility that they'll be able to make money from Vice one day. And Vice might even plausibly be able to say that it's worth multiple billions of dollars. I think we'll have a hard time believing that, but it's theoretically possible. Disney's saying, look, good luck to you. We're not going to get our money out of this.
What has Vice Media said about where it is right now? And what do the prospects for the company look like going forward?
Vice Media just raised $250 million via a loan from a consortium of lenders. One of them is George Soros, which I'm sure is going to excite some people. It wouldn't be borrowing money at this point if it didn't really need it. It's reorganizing itself. It's had some layoffs. The NCDB could say we're going to clean things up internally. Externally, they're saying, you know, we're hitting our numbers. Who knows what those numbers actually are? And it still has a large audience. You can debate the size of the audience, and it still has a brand that's worth something. And it still has this distributed cable network, which is worth something. So there's something there. It's the NCDB's job to extract some value out of it.
So in terms of investments, Bob Iger would probably rank this a little bit below Marvel, Pixar, and Lucas.
Yeah, you know, there was a world where Disney was going to buy this thing for some number in the billions, and Bob Iger sort of, in retrospect, that would have meant Bob Iger's sort of amazing track record in M&A would not look quite as amazing. And maybe, by the way, he doesn't get that Fox deal done if he sunk billions of dollars in Vice and that's not working. But he avoided that deal by not doing it, and now we're in a world where he runs basically one of the two most important media companies in the world.
Peter Kafka is the executive editor at Recode. He is also host of Recode Media, the weekly podcast. Peter, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thank you.
Coming up, John Cameron Mitchell somehow couldn't make his musical about a guy with a talking brain tumor into a TV show, so he turned it into a podcast. Welcome back to The Frame. I'm John Horn. Most hit podcasts fall into neat categories like politics, true crime, history, or pop culture. Anthem Homunculus is pretty much in a category all its own.
You don't even have to pledge. Just share me, like me, tap me on Twitter, crush me on Grindr, mortify me on MySpace. Just help my tumor go viral.
$1.50 pledged.
That's what I'm talking about.
Created by and starring actor, playwright, and Tony Award winner John Cameron Mitchell, Anthem is a fictional podcast told from the perspective of a live streamer with a talking brain tumor. And one more thing, it's a musical. A huge production with a cast of nearly 40 actors. Anthem features Glenn Close, Patti LuPone, Marion Cotillard, and many others. It's one of the first high-profile podcasts on the new platform, Luminary. I reached John Cameron Mitchell yesterday in New York City.
Oh, hello?
Hi, this is John Horn. Is this John Cameron Mitchell?
It is. How are you?
I'm well. You sound like you're sitting across.
I was curious if he listened to many radio dramas growing up.
I did. You know, in the 70s, there was still the Fire Sign Theater, which was, you know, our version of Monty Python, let's say. They were the hippie pranksters, and they had crazy albums that had vague stories and free associative madness. And also, if you remember the beginning of HBO, everyone had HBO. They just had a scrambler on the image, but you could hear anything. So we would listen to HBO in the early years. And if it was like a comedian like George Carlin, we would just tape it on our cassettes. And who needed to see him, right? He was hilarious.
When you were first imagining Anthem, did you picture it as what it is, as a musical podcast? Or did you think it would be a traditional stage show? Did you have any idea of what it would be in form?
The character has a brain tumor and is out of insurance in a town, in a state that hasn't expanded Medicaid. So he goes online to raise money to get his tumor out on a telethon app that we invent. And there's an opportunity for him to tell his life story, which is in many instances very similar to mine. And I was like, I want it to be a TV series, but it was way too weird. Everybody turned it down in Hollywood, respectfully. You know, I got a lot of resting pitch face. And I'm so much happier that we made it this way, because we were able to control it, be a little bit crazy, not worry about, you know, fitting into some pre-existing, you know, marketing niche.
You have a song that you sing called Homunculus, and it's sung from the perspective of an anthropomorphized tumor.
Suck on your memories, learn from your mistakes, curate the nightmares that keep you awake. I will text from upstairs just to say you're pretty. May you live to see my love turn to pity. I hate when you cry, so dry your eyes.
If you're staging this on stage in a film, the costume designer is going to say, what does this look like? But when you're doing it as a podcast, you don't have to worry about any of those things. And I'm wondering how the format actually liberates you in terms of being able to do that, where you wouldn't be able to do it if people were watching the performance.
I think because we're doing it low budget, we're in the studio with the actors, they don't have to shave, they can come in with their dog, they can, you know, not work, you know, be near their house. In fact, sometimes I would go, you know, Patti LuPone would be in London and I would say, could you just give me a line, you know, shout a line into your iPhone with a towel over your head and just text it to me and I'll drop it in. That would often work too. So there was an informality about it. There was a sense of play and fun and less like, oh my God, we've got thousands of people watching and waiting. Get it right. You know, there's a sense of fun and we can fix it easily. Granted, we had a lot of, you know, hundreds of people working on this and making it a very dense piece, but it feels very freeing, you know, and I'm a word guy and people are like, a picture is worth 1,000 words. I'm like, sometimes I prefer 1,000 words.
I want to ask you about how this show of yours is received, because if you go to a theater and see Hedwig, you are sitting there focused for however many minutes it takes to watch the show. If you're listening to a podcast, you could be in your car fighting traffic. You could be walking your dog. You could be making breakfast. You could be doing any number of different things. And do you think that changes the way that the entertainment, the story is received, because there's so many different ways anybody can listen to a podcast?
I think there are. I mean, with ours, because it's, you know, if you miss one line, you kind of miss the point of a scene. I think people will discover that they can't be emailing while they're listening, you know, something like driving or walking or doing the dishes is probably a better, you know, activity, because it's not using that part of your brain that requires story. But you're right, people aren't used to sitting in a chair and just listening to a podcast the way we used to do with radio. I'm missing listening to it in a group, but we don't really have that tradition of listening to audio stuff in a group. But, you know, maybe some people will. We're just the tip of the iceberg. There's going to be a lot more fictional podcasts crashing into our ears in the next couple of years. And Luminary, which is the new app that is distributing us, is very visionary that way. They kind of want to be the Netflix of podcasts, where most, you know, they have all the free ones or most of the free ones on their app, but they have 40 of their own under subscription. But they've allowed this kind of a budget piece to come forward, which wouldn't have happened in the free app era.
We're talking with John Cameron Mitchell about his new podcast, Anthem Homunculus. I want to play a little bit of a song by Glenn Close called Dissolve Me.
If a woman's blood is chaos and a man's sperm is form, my progeny must obey us. I command my first born.
when you're talking to an actor like Glenn Close, what are your conversations with her about what your ambitions are and how it will be different from anything else she's done before?
Well, she's a creature of the theater, so she's up for it. Film people are more like, you may have to cry in 15 minutes, you know. We're not sure when you're working tomorrow. You know, it's crazier, and you get a lot of more wacky people doing films because there's nothing regular about it. It's like a baby with no structure. I say to Glenn, look, this is fun. You know, at first it was I sent her her scenes, and she's like, this is great writing. For sure, let's do it. We live nearby. We can rehearse together. The dog can be there. And then she gets to sing a song in a style she's never done. She gets a punk song, you know, where she's demanding my, you know, forgiveness from my character, which she channels my mom, who was a difficult and brilliant woman who was very Catholic and demanded her say and her forgiveness.
I want to ask you about Glenn Close's character. She plays your character's mother, who has Alzheimer's, and there's so much in this piece about memory and remembrance, about what people remember, what they forget, what they're trying to remember, what they're trying to forget. And it is semi-autobiographical. Do you start re-remembering things differently? Does it force you to examine your assumptions about your own life in a new way?
Yeah, I mean, I grew up with loss. You know, my brother died at 4 years old when I was 14 in Kansas, and death was just in the air. You know, I came out into the era of AIDS, so life and love were suffused with mortality from the beginning, and even being in the closet felt like cowardice in that era. And I lost my dad, I lost my boyfriend, who had a drug problem. His loss, you know, really wrecked me. And in some ways, this whole piece is a response to that event. The character of Jairo, played by Nakane, who's a brilliant South African singer, plays a version of Jack, my boyfriend, who's struggling with substance abuse. So I knew that it was very unpleasant at times to write this and perform it the way it is in therapy when you're reliving stuff, especially at my age. I'm like, ugh. So I knew that by the end of this, I would be ready for a new part of my life. I'd be able to let go of perhaps a culture of loss and guilt. And I'm already feeling it.
Does this experience make you want to do this again, work in a podcast? And even if you don't, are there lessons that you've learned as a storyteller from working in this medium that you could apply to film or theater or television?
Very much so for all of it. I co-wrote the songs with Brian Weller, my composer, which was thrilling. But I love, you know, marrying music to story. So I do want to work in this venue more. And in fact, we want Anthem to be a continuing series so that each season is a completely different musical written by different people. You know, whoever's out, Kendrick Lamar, we're available.
Well, as we go out, let's listen to one of your favorites.
I would say Love You for Free.
That's what we're going to listen to, Love You for Free. John, thanks so much for coming on the show.
You're welcome, John. A real pleasure. I recommend starting at the chorus.
Anthem Homunculus is available now on the podcast platform Luminary. Coming up next, a leading voice in Gamergate challenges the homophobic tropes often found in video games. This is The Frame. I'm John Horn. Media critic and feminist Anita Sarkeesian made headlines a couple of years ago when she called out sexist and misogynistic depictions in video games. Sarkeesian's criticism triggered threats of graphic violence and virtually nonstop online harassment against her, part of what became known as Gamergate. Her latest project, through her website, Feminist Frequency, aims to root out toxic depictions of LGBTQ characters in gaming, and those depictions can fan the flames of hateful speech and intolerance. Sarkeesian's three-part video series also highlights games that feature more inclusive characters and storylines. The Frame contributor Stephen Cuevas recently spoke to Anita Sarkeesian and has our story.
In the first episode of the three-part Queer Tropes in Gaming series, directed by Anita Sarkeesian, host Carolyn Pettit explains its core objective.
We need more games in which queer characters and queer identities simply exist, whether the player chooses to access that content or not.
Sounds simple, but Sarkisian points out that such transformations never came so easy in Hollywood, a big influence on game producers.
Games, I think, still struggle with how to tell narrative, and so they pull out these tropes, which are not necessarily bad things, right? Too often, though, they are used to reinforce harmful stereotypes.
Let's hear a clip from early on in the first episode. Carolyn Pettit is talking about a 90s-era arcade game called Crime Fighters 2.
Players face queer-coded enemies in leather with exaggeratedly effeminate walking animations who literally dry-hump the player as an attack. But they don't stop there. These guys will dry-hump anything. If there's a lamppost handy, hell, they'll hump that too.
Yeah, it's just bananas.
It makes me laugh every time.
Yeah, I mean, like, when you first saw video games like that, what was your response? It was my first time, and I was like, are you kidding me?
We are providing a reframing for a lot of people who grew up on these games. So, like, games that you had played when you were younger that you didn't ever notice that queer folks are demonized in these various ways, that now all of a sudden you're like, oh my God, I played hours of this game and had no idea until I got older or were given the tools to be able to deconstruct them.
It's a digital realm that's also starting to draw scrutiny from national organizations that track hate and extremism, including the Anti-Defamation League.
There's issues with toxic behavior, hate and harassment in online games. Part of this issues with the culture of the game companies themselves.
Daniel Kelly is co-director of the ADL Center for Technology and Society, launched in 2016 to combat hate and extremism across the gaming universe, from the video games themselves to live streaming player platforms like Twitch. The ADL is now working with game designing companies to come up with video games that can foster inclusion and tolerance.
At the same time that there's toxic and hateful culture and practice in games, there's also, I think, incredible potential for games and the process of creating games to be a tool to help folks explore these issues and to change and sharpen their minds.
Anita Sarkisian says she has seen gradual improvements in recent years, partly because game designers are starting to see that being more inclusive is actually good for the bottom line.
Having a female protagonist is not going to make your game fail. If you make a good game, people are going to want to play it. We're seeing more opportunities for different kinds of narratives, protagonists, different kinds of villains than we have historically been seeing in games.
Feminist Frequency's Queer Tropes in Gaming series does spotlight some of those games. One that host Carolyn Pettit points to is the award-winning first-person exploration game Gone Home. The story includes a blossoming romance between two young women, Samantha and Lonnie.
And the game ultimately creates a feeling of warmth and safety that validates queer love.
Lonnie came over today. Lonnie, do you think you could ever... And that's when she kissed me.
Since its upload in March, the Queer Tropes in Gaming series has racked up tens of thousands of views on YouTube. The series is designed in part to help video games evolve and to spark healthy conversation. But Sarkisian disabled the comment section.
YouTube is trash, and people are very mean to us and post horrific things. So why would we allow that discourse to flourish in our spaces? We get to make the choice whether we want to allow that on our YouTube channel, which we do not.
Sarkisian knows something about horrific comments. Her 2012 series, Tropes vs. Women in Video Games, called out sexist and misogynistic portrayals and narratives in gaming. And it triggered a nasty backlash that included rape and death threats, and even the creation of a crude video game where players could assault Sarkisian. She spoke out about the attacks on Comedy Central's Colbert Report in 2014.
They're actually responding to the fact that we're saying gaming can no longer be this little boys' club anymore, that there are many of us women who have been playing our games our whole lives. We're challenging the status quo of gaming as a male-dominated space.
Well, okay, can't they have men? Do you see? Do you hear the applause for the idea of a male-dominated space?
The harassment was horrible, and it's not over.
The threats of violence have led to the occasional cancellation of speaking engagements and taking extra security precautions when out in public, including when visiting KPCC. But it turns out Sarkeesian's series also accidentally exposed the toxic nexus between the openly racist, anti-feminist, extremist ideology of the so-called alt-right and a faction within the gaming community.
It sounds nefarious because it actually is.
Sarkeesian believes the same type of online harassment and rhetoric used to attack her and others as far back as 2012 have since seeped into our daily politics.
You can see the copycat of the tactics that were used to harass us that then the Trump administration and supporters of him used in order to recruit, in order to spread conspiracy theories. And it is very concerning for the future of like online discourse and literally our political landscape, and we're seeing the costs of this.
Sarkeesian says she's now working on a project that'll delve deeper into the connections between extremist ideology and the world of gaming. For The Frame, I'm Stephen Cuevas.
And that's our show for today. I'm John Horn. Thanks for listening. We'll see you back here tomorrow.